It's May 8th, 2016, and this is the Rhode Island Educator's Guide to Personalized Learning. I'm your host, Arthur Barriff, and today you're about to hear Nicole Phelps interview Joe DiMartino, founder and president of the Center for Secondary School Redesign and an expert on school transformation towards more personalized learning practices. Nicole Phelps, our podcaster, is a high school English teacher in Rhode Island. Enjoy.
Hello and welcome. I'm Nicole Phelps, and I am here with author and education redesign leader, Joseph DiMartino. Hello, Joseph, and welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Okay, good. All right, so let's begin with developing a little bit of background. Could you briefly describe your involvement in education, and what is your current role?
In 1986, my wife and I added two more children to our family. We had four. We had two children adopted from Korea and two biological children, and we adopted two boys from Guatemala who were aged 8 and 12 at the time. And that's kind of when I realized I missed my calling. But basically, I became the biggest advocate in the state of Rhode Island to advocate for English learners, was invited all over the state to be on all kinds of advisory commissions, but particularly the biggest one was to be an advisor to the Commissioner of Education, and I was chair of this group that advised the commissioner on issues affecting what we call limited English proficient students at that time, LEP students. And the other thing that happened is that my kids, now because I adopted an 8-year-old and 12-year-old, and I had earlier adopted a 6-year-old boy from Korea, all of my children were in high school at the same time, and there were some that had special needs, and there were some that were soaring honor students, and there were some that were still learning English, okay? So I got to see in real time the differences between all those different tracks in the high school. It wasn't about, maybe it was different 2 years ago. It was all at the same time. And it got... We were able to make some progress in elementary and middle school, but when we got to high school, things got really bad. So we talked earlier about the challenges in high schools. Well, high schools are represented a real serious challenge. And my son, Eric, the youngest of the group, presented the biggest challenge. And his experience in high school is really kind of what still motivates, well, all of their experiences, but particularly Eric's, when... I was the soccer coach, and I was involved with the LEP Advisory Committee and all that other stuff. And my son spent 3 years as a freshman, never having earned enough credits to become a sophomore. And he went off to St. Andrews, Barrington, managed to go into a private school. It was the first of my children that couldn't make it through the same high school that I went through and with all my siblings, and my father went through with all his siblings. And all of us have went on to be successful in different strands. Eric couldn't make it through. And then when he comes home a month after he started at St. Andrews, he sits down with my wife and I, and he says, "I'm not stupid."
Wow.
I said, "We know that, Eric. We know you're not stupid." He said, no, I really mean it. I'm not stupid. And we said... We really mean it. You're not stupid. And he said, "Why did they make me feel so stupid at that other school?" It was a telling thing. And what was the difference? Well, he had an advisory program at St. Andrews. He was 1 year too old to go to the med school when he started, which would have been the solution for him instead of St. Andrews. So being an advocate for English learners really ended up getting me a position at the Education Alliance at Brown University. And from there, that was at a time when Ted Sizer was still at Brown, who we mentioned earlier, and I got to connect with Ted and the people at the Coalition of Essential Schools, and it was a time when Dennis Litke and Elliot Washer came to Brown to be at the Annenberg Institute as Annenberg Fellows. So I got to meet a lot of people that really cared about changing schools and changing high schools, and that had some great ideas. So I was very fortunate. It was serendipitous that ended up in that position at that time. I was actually hired to help a woman put together a secondary school, what we called restructuring effort at that time. And the day I started, she gave her notice. So I ended up directing this initiative of 10 different projects around the Northeast around high school redesign. Or secondary school. We did some middle school stuff too, but not much. So that's how I got into it. So that was the issue. For me, the big issue was not so much creating a new school, but how do I figure out how to make it work for all the Erics in the world out there? Mm-hmm. Okay, not just the ones lucky enough to get into the Met or to hear about the Met and go there, but how do we make it so all schools, where all the kids are, can become better and different? So I spent the last 20 years doing that. That's what I've been working on. And Center for Secondary School Redesign grew out of the work at Brown, just like Ted Sizer left and the Coalition of Essential Schools left and the National School Reform Faculty left. Brown's a great place to start things, not necessarily a great place to continue if you wanted to work with practitioners out in schools and districts.
Okay.
All right, it's a long answer, but...
it's a fantastic answer, and it kind of... It answered my next question, which was what was driving your decision to establish the Center for Secondary School Redesign?
Yeah.
So what was your vision when you established the center?
Our vision was to provide technical assistance and professional development to existing high schools, middle schools and high schools, the secondary schools, to become more personalized and student-centered, student-focused. That's basically what we've done for the last 20 years, starting, you know, the first 10 years at Brown, the next 10 years at the Center for Secondary School Redesign, separate from the university. And that's it. I mean, that's really the focus. So part of that is to go into, you know, classrooms, schools, help people figure out how they can become more student-centered. And that's basically what we do. We felt from the beginning that the place to go to get that done would be through the National Association of Secondary School Principals, the group of middle school and high school principals across the country, and then we ended up creating Breaking Ranks 2 and Breaking Ranks in the Middle for them. And Breaking Ranks 2, I don't know, they distributed probably 150,000 copies of it, and it was a big part of the conversation. And it got us real excited. Things were going to happen. And then No Child Left Behind was passed, and it just kind of derailed a lot of stuff. No Child Left Behind has passed, so which is good. So now we've got other things that can be focused in on. It was at the beginning, we spent a lot of time more with Elliot Washer than with Dennis Litke, but with the leadership at the Met as they were wrestling through how to create the Met School and what to do to really try to focus in on how you personalize learning. So a lot of what we believe in is similar. The basic difference is we think, I mean, I had this conversation with both of those guys, and they don't think you can change existing schools. And they may be right, but that's where the kids are. You know, 95% of the students are in those other traditional, they're stuck in those traditional schools.
And that's where we have to try.
And that's why, so we got to keep trying. So we're going to keep trying, right? Right. Yeah.
So with your experience in working with administrators through the redesign process, what advice would you give to teachers that are passionate about personalized learning?
Over the past 5, 6, 7 years, I've devoted more of our energy to working with classroom teachers than with building leaders. And actually what you're going to be discussing later on and asking the right question. But moving towards an inquiry-based approach in the classroom, where you open things up and you don't have the answers, you have the questions, really engages students in a real meaningful and powerful way. That's important. It's important to have kids be known and known well. So that's the idea of having an advisory program is really critical and really important. And we really believe that student-driven learning, projects that students create and design rather than projects they're told they got to do, is at the heart of getting that real deep learning. That student engagement can't be replaced by something else. You know, if there's something they care about, I heard earlier about an exhibition that a student just did at the Met School. If it's something the kids care about, it's amazing what they will do. And the learning they will get out of it is phenomenal. One of the things that I neglected that I want to talk a little bit, it ties a little bit to those kinds of exhibitions. This is a larger scale thing. We're going back when the work was still based at Brown, we worked with 5 of the New England states to come up with, to support them to create new visions for high schools,
okay.
Guidance for high schools. And one of the states that we worked with was the state of New Hampshire. Back in 2005, mandated the elimination of the Carnegie unit. So in schools in New Hampshire now, at least in theory, cannot base course credit. Course credit must be based on demonstrating mastery of course competencies and cannot be based on seat time. So they've mandated totally eliminating the Carnegie unit, which created a number of great opportunities. And it's the thing that, we were saying for 30 years, Carnegie unit gets in the way. It gets in the way of learning, and everyone agreed with that. And well, now it's gone. Everybody's like, oh, God, now what do we do? But New Hampshire has created some great opportunities for what they call ELOs, or extended learning opportunities. They're very similar to the projects that happen at the Met. They're based in the community, they're tied to course level competencies, and therefore course credit. So it's more traditional than a med school exhibition would be, but it's because it's tied to specific standards to earn credit for specific courses.
Yeah.
But it's just opened the door so that all the high schools in New Hampshire now are offering opportunities to do what they call ELOs, all tied to and aligned to competency. So it's an exciting new happening. And in the past couple of years, after New Hampshire has done it, Maine and Vermont have followed suit. So they have similar policies now. And it's an option here in Rhode Island that nobody ever takes advantage of, that you can offer, that credit can be based on demonstrating mastery as opposed to seat time. So it's here in the books and has been since we worked with the Rhode Island group in the first set of the high school redesign standards back in 2000, I think. I don't know, 2000, somewhere back then. And so it's on the books, still there. I know Commissioner Gist was trying to get some schools to actually implement it, but I don't know of any that have. I'm not sure about the Mayoral Academy, the new high school that they've started, but we talked about wanting to move towards a competency-based progression when I spoke with them around the high school design. So So schools like the Met don't have to fudge seat time anymore. They can just give a competency-based diploma and meet the state requirements. So that, I mean, that's positive. That's an interesting, a very positive change that that I encourage all of you to bring up at your school to talk about ways that you can do that. On the other hand, so I'm going. So you want to talk about the book? Okay, I'll go. I'm sorry.
No, I apologize. This is great information. I thank you for sharing all that.
So when we wrote the book, Personalizing the High School Experience, what we've learned in the last 5-6 years about how schools have wrestled with this whole competency-based progression, mm-hmm. have updated in our mind some of the things that happened that we wrote about in the book. It's actually validated them, and I think it makes the book actually more appropriate now than when it first came out, because you have this option in all of the New England states except Massachusetts. Massachusetts is a little tough, but to go to a competency-based approach, that excitement is something that we've been focused on, and we've just finished working with the group called the New England Network for Personalization and Performance, a network of 13 high schools across New England, mm-hmm. that basically have put together and come together as a network to support each other to move towards personalization and performance assessment as the vehicle for bringing change. And with that group, after significant conversation within our team, we decided that there are two places to begin. One is to help them personalize through an advisory program or something like that. Mm-hmm. The other one is to move to inquiry-based approaches in the classroom.
Okay.
Where your kids, and basically in those two elements, if the idea is to have the students develop and learn how to exercise their voice and choice in what they do. So just giving them choice, say at the end of their year they can do a senior project, without having given them some scaffolding to build on, not having given them the opportunity to make smaller choices along the way or to exercise their voice in you know, key ways.
Yes.
It just makes it hard. But what we basically learned over the last 5 years, and to get to this deeper student-driven learning in an existing school, you got to change a number of things all at the same time. So inquiry-based approach in the classroom, student agency, where kids actually have a say in their learning, have a say in the control of the school. Three or four of the schools in the network chose to create a site-based governing body that's actually the governing body of the school that has a majority of students elected by their peers. So students in Pittsfield, New Hampshire, govern everything. Who becomes an advisor goes to them, okay?
Wow.
They're part of the hiring process. They have real, real authority. And that's something that, again, ties back to my experience here at Brown when Bob McCarthy, who was Ted Sizer's deputy director of the Coalition of Central Schools, became my real mentor that I talked to on a regular basis about what should this be about. The idea of really personalizing the experience through projects, through student-driven learning and student agency. And one of the things we learned is that when giving students leadership opportunities like this site council opportunity, giving them the ability to understand, to exercise how their voice and choice matters, mm-hmm. Really ended up with students becoming leaders in the change initiative in the schools. So
That's
students
fantastic.
And teachers had often I think more. And the reason for that is out of these 13 high schools in 11 districts, all but two had either a new principal or a new superintendent or both, or more than one of both. Mm-hmm. So 11 of the 13 had leadership changes that mattered. Okay, but the students were still there, and the teachers are still there. So focusing leadership on you guys and your students turned out to be a really positive aspect of what we were able to learn.
Thank you for listening to Nicole Phelps' interview of Joe DiMartino, founder and president of the Center for Secondary School Redesign. I'd like to thank Alejandro Da Silva for our theme music and you for listening. Please tell your friends and colleagues to subscribe to this podcast, and please leave a comment and a rating. We'll be back soon with another episode of the Rhode Island Educator's Guide to Personalized Learning. And remember, learning is always personal.